What was the triangle? The Trinity. The triangle is no more than the Trinity. The three basic elements, waking, dreaming, sleeping, the Creator, the Preserver, and the Redeemer, all kinds of these, the Father, Son, Holy Ghost, whatever you want, you wish to call it. And even this, unfortunately, has come to be regarded as a sex symbol. You could meditate upon that. You could meditate upon the, you remember the same Chin Mudra here also. This is the Bindu, the point of union, and these three. These three are to be discarded, and the Bindu regarded as that first beginning. The first beginning, the original beginning of the beginning of the beginning. That is the Bindu. And the Bindu also may mean a drop, a point, a drop, etc., etc. Then this has the point down. So this thing comes up, comes down. Then they said, oh my God, the whole thing is, the divine is pouring down. Ah, the human is ascending up, going up. The divine comes down, and as it comes down, we have been discussing the spiral business all these weeks. It comes down and down and down and down and gets lost on in matter, and then there is evolution towards the divinity. Okay? There is involution of the spirit in matter, and then the matter eventually evolves into the spirit. So they said there must be a corresponding ascent. That's the famous Star of David. Yes, the famous Star of David. And it is also the chakra for the heart center. Then they said, right, you know, you raise your energy and your consciousness up to the heart where the divine will come down to help you. The divine does not come down to help you below the heart. Below the heart it's all the vital principles, life force. You are caught up in life, eating, sex, and all the rest of it. So it is your business to raise your consciousness up to the heart center, and if you are able to do that, from there on the divine takes over. The next is the Vishuddha chakra. Vishuddha is absolute purity. Absolute purity is possible only when these two have come together. Divine grace and human effort have come together. And when the divine grace has lifted you, your consciousness above the heart, that is, above you in the emotional sphere, and lifted you up to the throat, that is when real purity is possible. Otherwise, no purity is possible. Don't struggle with all that. Right. When they drew this, I'll buy it a little bigger. That was the philosophy they wanted the meditator to focus all his attention upon. That is, love your God with all your heart, with all your might, and with all your mind, and etc., and with all your soul. Which, to me, your famous distinction symbolizes.
I learned it. He didn't tell me in so many words, but when I saw a Greek Orthodox Archbishop do that, it was then that suddenly it hit me. He didn't do like ladies and gentlemen do it. When he did it with his whole being. He touched his head, and he touched his heart, and his shoulders, and then completely doubled up, like the Padahastasana. Then I saw the meaning. Love your heart with all, love your God with all your mind, with all your heart, with all your might, and with your whole being. Collapse. It may not be Father, Son, Holy Ghost, because I have one problem. If Father has got only one point, the head, the Son has got only one point, the heart, why should this Holy Ghost have two? it's injustice. Partiality. Partiality. But if you treat it as a symbol, as a gesture which dramatizes the commandment, thou shalt love your God with all your mind, with all your heart, with all your strength, strength being symbolized by your arms, shoulders, and then with all your being, you collapse. They tried this, on this symbol, you fix your whole being. Try to understand it mentally. Try to pour your devotion towards it. It's not enough merely to understand it intellectually, then it becomes dry. And when you enter into the symbolism, you begin to love it. The heart. And therefore, this is also the symbol for the heart center. And with your whole being, be devoted to it. Probably a simple man or woman suggested it's a bit too difficult. You draw an interlaced triangle, hexagon, and you want me to love it? There's nothing in it for me to love it. And then there's a bait.
I'll help you. It's a pure matter of I'll help you. They did the same thing, not very very different. If you see the two,
sorry.
No, then you are hiding from behind.
If you fix the head there, right? The feet here. One arm there, another arm here, the third arm there, the fourth arm there, and the whole body here. You're the figure. The reason why most of the Indian gods have four arms. Same thing. Instead of vacantly looking at a hexagon, if you don't feel like it, put a figure into it, look at it. And you have the same feeling, the same attitude, the same philosophy or what have you. And also, we'll finish this in just a moment, and then we'll go on to the figures themselves. Also, you remember the point here, caught up in this triangle, and the point within this triangle is the beginning of this creation. This is the beginning, which is called the causal body. and it gets caught up in the three, all kinds of trinities. All kinds of trinities, including the trinity father, mother, son. All, father, mother, offspring, that sort of thing, all the whole lot. But then, it doesn't stop with just one triangle. It keeps multiplying. Once the one has become three, the 3 plus 1 and 1 plus 3, it goes on and on and on and on and on infinitely. And to symbolize that, they have another lovely little yantra. Unfortunately, it's too small. All of you may not be able to see. It's called the Sri Yantra. I think most of you have seen this in some diagrams. Once again, I am supposed to look at this, contemplate, one becomes many, infinite. And yet, though the one becomes many, it is still the one. It has never become many. One cannot become many. It's like dream. In dream, I, the one person, dreaming, dream within myself, not outside, hundreds and thousands of people, but still it is still the one. I have not become many. My brain has not become many. Still the same one. When I understand that principle, it's finished.
Just one word more about this, and then this is said to be. No, leave it here. This is said to be the figure of Krishna. They say that this is another historical personality incarnation. Krishna is also supposed to be a historical personality, and but yet. They introduced a speciality in this picture of Venkatesha. That is, the eyes are covered, not like the horse, the sides are not covered, but the front is covered. You wonder why. They declare that it is symbolic of a wonderful lesson, a wonderful truth, that God doesn't ever gets mad at you. God doesn't hate you, God doesn't judge you, God doesn't get angry with you. If you cover your eyes in front and look at somebody else through the corner of your eyes, you can never frown, try. You can never frown through the corner of your eyes. Even if you hate me, you can only look with love. Nothing else, no other emotion is possible. Yeah, here, beautiful you are. You cannot frown, all right. When you look at someone with the corner of your eyes, you are looking with love. It's not possible to do otherwise. So they said, God never gets angry with you, don't be afraid. God is love, and He can only love you. Whatever you do, doesn't matter what you are. That's one interesting feature there. And the other is the left hand. The right hand points to the feet, which is the message of Krishna, which is the message of Christ. Come and fall at my feet, surrender. Surrender to me. Krishna said so, and Christ also said so. Come to me, all that ye labor. But then there is one interesting lesson that is symbolized by the left hand holding the thigh. Tavan matram avabdhim gamayati bhajatam. If you come to me and surrender yourself to me, this ocean of worldly existence will come only up to your thigh level. You won't drown in it. But there is a lot more to it than appears on the surface. That is, don't expect that you will have no headache at all. Have taken refuge in God and He has taken on all my burdens. No. You will still have to wade through the whole process of existence up to your thigh level. It will rise up to your thigh level. Don't worry, you won't drown. But don't ask for, complete freedom from pain, freedom from agony, freedom from sorrow, freedom from illness. No, that's absurd, unrealistic. It's a beautiful symbol. It enables you to bear what you can bear, knowing that not more is ever given to you. You are never subjected to more pain or more suffering than you can endure. And if you have seen as many people as I have, you are also never given more pleasure than you can stomach. Never. I have never seen one person who has said, everything is marvelous with me. There is always a semicolon there, and then the next word, but, starts. I have good health, and I have plenty of money, I have this, I have that, but. So, this but will always be there, don't worry. Take what comes, and if you have, if you are devoted to God, it will come to you only up to the thigh level. You will never drown. This is a very interesting symbol. It's called Ganesha. And as you know, we all start with our prayers with Jai Ganesha, Jai Ganesha. This is Swami Sivananda's speciality. He never started any function without Jai Ganesha. And there is a belief that one who remembers Ganesha before commencing any auspicious or even worldly activity is blessed with success. If you want success, worship Ganesha first. Marvelous. Love sounds simple. And then you are asked to bow down and worship a funny figure which has an elephant head. And this Ganesha is supposed to have a vehicle which is a mouse. Sounds ridiculous. The whole thing sounds ridiculous. And naturally, many people, many intellectuals in India and many foreign enthusiasts, tourists, have ridiculed the whole thing. But then instead of merely ridiculing it, can I try to understand it? The form appears to be human, and yet I have never seen a human form with an elephant head on. What may it mean? If I begin to probe into it, then I probably understand something more about it. This elephant is supposed to be riding on that mouse. Elephant riding on a mouse, and the mouse doesn't die. And then one of the mantras during the worship says, Lord, you are lame and you travel very fast riding on that mouse. An elephant riding on a mouse traveling very fast. The whole thing seems to be absurd. Then I begin to contemplate, not understand it with the intellect, but know it with the heart. What happens? From there, a completely different type of knowledge arises, which is the knowledge of mysticism. Maybe it means something. Maybe the mouse means something. What does the mouse mean? I am also afraid of a rat. I am not afraid of anything else. Not now. Especially when I was in the ashram, I was scared. I must tell you, now I am scared of mosquitoes and they love me. Did you notice yesterday? Well, there was one mosquito. There were so many people, they ignored everybody and came and alighted on my ears. Extraordinary love they have for me. And only the mosquitoes love me like that. 200 people may be there, one mosquito comes into the hall and comes straight to me. And that's the only thing I cannot tolerate. And in the ashram, I used to be scared of rats, because my whole room was full of papers. Letters to be answered, books, and manuscripts, Swami Shivananda's manuscripts, writings, and this, that, and so on. Every piece of paper was precious. If you knew what it was to work under Swami Shivananda, it was terrible. If one piece of paper was lost, he would make you jump up and down, produce it. Now, not tomorrow, not in the afternoon. And I hear some noise, especially during rainy season, during the rains, they come out of their holes and want to come into the rooms. A little bit of noise, I get scared, get up, light the lamp, look for it, chase it out, and plug all the holes and close all the doors and windows, sultry or stuffy, it doesn't matter. And the mouse seems to be the only animal which bites paper, most of all, merely in order to sharpen its teeth, or for the pleasure of it, we don't know, because it doesn't eat paper. The mouse does not eat paper. It merely bites and shreds it. You have invented some shredders. You must get some mice from India. He shreds this paper, leaves it there and goes away. And so, according to us, these books and papers are the sources of our knowledge. And here is a mouse which comes and destroys that very thing for no purpose, for no obvious reason. Is there a thing like that in me too? Is there a factor, a psychological factor in me, which destroys knowledge for no reason? I can see that, yes. The doubting intellect, which asks why, where, the question is not relevant. Why did God create the world? What does it matter to you? The world is there. Deal with it now. Why must I do this? Why must I not do that? Why must I pray? Why must I meditate? No, it doesn't ask, why must I eat? This why is like the mouse chewing paper. Why? And without any sense, rhyme or reason, this goes on all the time. And yet it is not possible to get rid of it, it is not possible to destroy it. And therefore this mouse is not destroyed by the elephant sitting on it. It is not possible to destroy your intellect. Something else has to be done with it. I have to do something else in order that this mouse may still be a vehicle. The intellect may still be a vehicle. Who is the rider? The elephant. And I look at all these faces and the face of Ganesha. I look at all these human figures and look at this figure of Ganesha. I can see one thing. One essential and vital difference. We are capable of three forms of action: mental, verbal, and physical. And in our case, the mental action takes place on top, the verbal action a little below, and the physical action far away from these two. Thought takes place in the brain, speech in the mouth. The mouth is not as large as the brain, it's much narrower. And then there is a sudden bottleneck here, the throat, and then a division into two arms, then five fingers. So that a good thought is expressed narrowly, a little bit, it escapes narrowly. If you watch your own thoughts, sometimes, you know, you are magnanimous, you are extremely charitable, you are generous, the thoughts are. But then even before the magnanimous, charitable thoughts are expressed, they are already narrowed down. You are not worried about the consequences. You are not worried about thinking big. You are worried about talking big. Oh, well, you may pin me down later on. So you're worried about the consequences. But then, when even this magnanimous speech comes down to action, half of it is gone there, in the neck. And then, the rest of it divides into two halves. One flows through one arm, the other flows through the other arm. And then it's again divided into 10 fingers. By the time this magnanimous thought comes down to action, there is almost nothing. So there is this discrepancy between our thought, word and deed. If you don't want to mince word, call it hypocrisy. It's the simplest word. Therefore, our life is full of hypocrisy. And therefore, we do not succeed. There is no strength. There is no power. And therefore we fail in whatever we do. Why do I worship this Ganesha at the beginning of all that we do, in order that we may remember this? Ha ha. I realize the thought, word and deed becoming running in completely different directions. And you, Ganesha, you have got all these three together. In the case of the elephant, the three are glued together. Thought, word and deed. The deed comes more prominently than the word. In our case, the other way around. Yeah, that's what we do. We talk big, holding our hands behind, so that we may not even, you know, by mistake, do something good. Or put the hands in our trouser pockets. Make it difficult. Make it a little more difficult to act quickly. So when the organs of thought, word and deed are glued together, they are all perfectly synchronized, and therefore a person has the wisdom, not merely the courage, to ensure that his thought, word and deed are in perfect alignment. No power on earth can resist him, and so there is obviously success in whatever you do. Similarly, in this manner, you find most of these deities that the Hindus have invented and are supposed to be worshipping have some philosophical or ethical significance. These are not to be intellectually understood, but understood with the heart. And therefore, the Hindu again invented a system of worship, adoration, which bypassed the intellect and literally learned through the heart, learned by heart. Learning by heart is not memorizing, but learning by heart. Opening your heart to learn, not your opening your brain to learn. That is called worship. In that, you do not approach an image of Ganesha or Krishna or Venkatesha, thinking, ah, this is a very good, beautiful symbol representing creation. But you approach as you would approach the presence of God and worship, adore that symbol. I have brought some slides. It may be possible to show it in the afternoon. I'll bring the afternoon session. You can screen, put the screen down here and see if it works.
Here's the screen.
Yeah. If it doesn't work, we'll do it in the evening. I'll show the script. It should be all right. I was only thinking of the afternoon light.
Yeah, but we'll, we have done before.
Ah, good, good. So we'll do it in the evening. Because this is not merely intellectual understanding. To the devotee, the God in that image is present. God is present in that image. It doesn't